Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, the music business year so far. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
We're recording a new episode of Setlist, Chris. Are you very excited?
I'm mildly excited.
Come on, get the energy up.
Mainly, the main reason for my excitement is that once this podcast goes out, now this is relying on you remembering how to edit a podcast.
Which I might not.
We're currently only in step one of this process. But presuming that you remember how to edit this podcast and we get it published and it's out on the internet, at least people will stop messaging me on social saying, when is Setlist coming back? So for that reason, I'm excited that I won't keep having to go back and saying, hey, we're coming back soon, promise. Because there's only so many times you can say we're coming back soon, promise, before it starts to sound a little bit like your promises aren't worth much. Yeah. So I'm super excited that we are back with Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. Because, yeah, we took a very long Christmas break.
Yes, it was, I mean, longer than expected. We talked about taking a slightly extended Christmas break, but this one has ended up being even more extended than we intended because of...
Well, because Andy hasn't stopped celebrating Christmas until last week.
That's it.
In fact, he's still wearing a Christmas jacket. He's still dressed up as Santa Claus. He's wearing a very red jacket as we speak.
I happen to have a red jumper on.
So that's why Andy Malt decided he was going to have a 2.5 month Christmas celebration this year. And therefore, the Christmas break extended.
Yes, I've just been too full of Christmas dinner for 3 meals a day to get up here into my attic to record a podcast. Actually, as you may have guessed, it's COVID related because everything is, isn't it?
Yeah, Andy died of COVID-19. So unfortunately...
Don't be flippant about that. Lots of people have died.
We had to get a resurrection done and that takes time. But he's back. So we're back and all is fine.
This has been a bit of a... I'm feeling really revitalized this week because actually the reason we've not been doing it is because I've been homeschooling and that... I'm not a teacher and I am glad because now my children are being looked after by people who are paid to do that sort of thing and I don't have to do it anymore and I can get on with my real passion, which is recording podcasts in an attic.
And there's a whole 2 weeks until the Easter holidays, so...
Oh, God.
What did you learn by being a teacher as well as a music business journalist / podcast host? What were your key learnings of the last 2.5 months?
Apart from me being glad that I'm not a teacher, I learned things. I think it was nice hanging out with my daughter every day. Actually, it was, you know, quite enjoyed that. And I did learn things because they teach us stuff in school. I'm pretty sure 5-year-olds are now learning things that I didn't learn till I was 9 or 10. So I'm assuming education's got better since I was a child. And we did some music lessons. So I wouldn't say I learned things about rhythm, but I learned new ways of being taught rhythm. And that was fun. Although the music teacher on the videos that the school was sending through had the worst singing voice. So I'm quite glad that I don't have to listen to that anymore.
That's why you only learned about rhythm. You didn't learn about melody because she couldn't hold a melody.
Not at all. Well, she had no timing as well. She couldn't hold a melody. And as she was teaching you rhythm, she was going in and out of time all over the place.
Was she teaching live?
Eventually, no. These were like, most of the lessons were live, but or pre-recorded by teachers at school. But these were like ones they sent through from, there's a government website that has video school.
So there was
lessons.
No excuse. It wasn't that this poor teacher was having to suddenly do a Zoom lesson.
No.
Live. She was just music teacher.
No, she was a music teacher. And I don't know if they had complaints, but a couple of weeks before we finished the homeschooling, they did change to a different music teacher who, if anything, was a little bit too good at singing. It was like, why are you a teacher? You could probably get paid for this.
Not at the moment. That's the problem.
Maybe not. Maybe she's not normally a music teacher. Maybe that was it. Maybe that was why she came in last minute. I don't know. Maybe the other teacher was sacked. I mean, she was, it was like, it was so bad. I probably shouldn't lay into teachers who have been doing a very difficult job, but her voice was very grating. I did not look forward to those lessons.
I mean, suppose you don't have to be able to sing to be a music teacher, because you might be playing the piano, or maybe you're a drummer or something like that. But you'd think it would help, particularly if you're the music teacher that they're using to make videos that they're sending out to kids all over the country.
Yes.
You think you could find a music teacher who could sing for that. But moving on from your home teaching experiences, let's
just... Yes, it's not what we're here to talk about.
It's not what we're here to talk about. But I suppose we've been away for, what, 2.5 months? Actually, more than that. Probably nearly 3 months, actually, because I think we finished... Yeah. In the middle of December before Christmas, didn't we? We've been away for 3 months, but the good news is nothing happened in the music business in those 3 months. We happened to pick a few months where literally, I mean, apart from obviously the headline grabbing, occasionally controversial select committee hearing on the streaming economy. But other than that, and of course, ongoing COVID calamities and the extension of shutdown and increased demand for more government support to get the music industry through COVID. But other than that, oh, and the streaming service getting bought and Spotify launching in a load more countries and Sony further expanding its distribution business and a whole load of very interesting litigation in the pop courts. But I mean, other than that, nothing has happened in the last 3 months. So it doesn't matter that we had an extended Christmas break.
Huh, yes, you're right. As listeners may have noticed there, quite a lot happened in the last 3 months. It was an incredibly annoying time not to be doing a podcast. But the good news is we've chosen a week to come back where almost nothing at all has happened. So we're going to be able to recap all of those things that did happen while we were off for you today. And then we'll get everyone up to speed, ready for next week when we properly start doing the podcast as normal again.
Yeah, so this week's edition of Setlist is not the last 7 days in the music business. It's the last 3 months in the music business, touching in on some, although not all, of the things that I just listed. What are we going to cover in this 3 months in one edition of Setlist?
Well, most of the things you just mentioned, I think, but there's going to be the growing debate around user-centric streaming royalties, the issues facing artists who want to tour Europe post-Brexit once touring Europe and anywhere is possible again, and more. First off, we're going to go into that select committee inquiry that you mentioned, which, I mean, that provided lots of intrigue and interest for a couple of weeks, didn't it?
Yeah, so this economics of streaming inquiry that was launched by the Parliamentary Select Committee for Culture here in the UK last year. I mean, obviously, we did talk about this back in the autumn when it was first announced, and it was all kind of building on the fixed streaming and broken record campaigns that gained momentum earlier last year as COVID shutdown began, which we also talked about on the podcast. Indeed, we had those two special editions that we published last year that I keep retweeting and reposting, not because I'm trying to get extra mileage out of work we've already done. Well, partly that. But I suppose in terms of all of the issues that have been discussed as this select committee hearing has gone into actually having oral hearings, and when all of the many, many submissions that were made by various people in the music industry and the tech sector were actually published on the Culture Select Committee's website, all of those debates pretty much just follow on from the debates that we've been having here at CMU in partnership with the Music Managers Forum through the Dissecting the Digital Dollar project over the last 5 years. Hasn't really been anything dramatically new, I don't think. So therefore, actually, in some ways, in terms of us giving context and background and opinions on the various things that have been discussed at all of these oral hearings, pretty much everything we've got to say is in this podcast we published last year. So on one level, it hasn't been so annoying that we haven't been doing editions of Setlist as all these oral hearings have been happening. Although, on another level, it has been quite annoying. Mainly because there are certain things about these oral hearings which are quite annoying, and we haven't had chance to moan about them on the podcast.
Yeah, people have been getting things wrong.
People keep getting things wrong. Or often not completely wrong, but not quite right either. Or that people use slightly misleading terms. But personally, what I found the most annoying thing, I'm assuming that that's what we're going to talk about in our...
That's the main thing. This is just the personal grievance podcast.
I mean, I've written a lot about these oral hearings and all of the submissions.
I've done music teachers.
Yeah, so I'll lay into MPs and then we'll work out who we're going to lay into for the final section of the podcast. But I've written about the oral hearings. I've written about the submissions loads in the CMU Daily. There's a whole timeline within the CMU Library on the website that basically aggregates all of those reports and puts them into a logical order. So I've kind of done all of that in the written word. But what I've not done in those articles is moan so much. Actually, I did in a couple, because the thing that I got really bored of was this constant debate about how do we define a stream. And that was a repeated conversation throughout the various oral hearings that we've had, which was different MPs saying, well, is a stream more like DVD rental or joining a gym or having an internet service provider account or going shopping at Lidl and them giving you some CDs in a bag and maybe you go on holiday? Or is it more like, I don't know, going out into the street and singing? And there was just so many definitions of what a stream might be. A stream is a stream. Can we just all agree that when music streams, it streams? But of course, the reason why this idea of defining a stream is contentious is, well, two reasons. First of all, you've got the sale versus license contractual interpretation debate. And then you've got the performer ER. Is it a communication? Is it a making available? Is it a rental debate? And actually, those two things have sometimes been confused during these oral hearings, or actually quite often, we ended up in these tedious how do we define a stream conversations without just being upfront and honest. Actually, when we're talking about how do we define a stream is a stream is a stream. The only reason we're trying to define it in legal terms or copyright law terms is because it potentially has an impact on how the money gets shared out, usually between record labels and artists. And there are certain interpretations of old record contracts or certain interpretations of copyright law that could mean that artists would either get a bigger royalty on old deals with record labels, or that maybe this thing called equitable remuneration should be applied to streams just like it is to radio and so on.
Yeah, and the main debate has really been about equitable remuneration and whether that should be applied to streams. A lot of the organisations and companies putting forward submissions, certainly representing the songwriter and artist side, have said that it should. The major labels have been very anti-ER on streams and have said that it would be too complicated and it wouldn't work and it would just mess everything up. The streaming companies have basically said, we don't care so long as it doesn't cost us any more money. And so it seems likely that one of the big recommendations that will come out of this inquiry is going to be on ER, and it may well be that ER should be applied to streams.
Yeah, and it's because of this focus on ER, equitable remuneration, that the whole is a stream a rental, is it a broadcast, is it a communication? That's where that all comes from, because as it currently stands under UK copyright law, obviously the law splits the copyright up into its different elements, what we call the different controls. And this idea of ER, where artists have a statutory right to payment when their music is used, that comes through the collective licensing system, ER applies as it currently stands if the communication element, the performance element, or the rental element is exploited, but not if it's the reproduction element, adaptation, distribution, making available. So the music industry currently says, well, it's reproduction and making available, no ER. If we said, aha, it's actually rental or it's communication, then the ER would apply. So therefore, if we want to find a way to get ER on streams, one way is to reinterpret what a stream is in copyright law terms and define it in a way that means that ER would start being paid. So that's a debate that we have in the music industry, except that the people who kept raising this question, is it a rental? Is it a broadcast? Is it more like a DVD? Is it more like a club or a gym? All of that. These are MPs. And if you're an MP and you think there should be ER on streams, you don't have to interpret copyright law in a way that makes that happen. Just rewrite copyright law. Just edit copyright law so it says there is ER on streams. You can do that as an MP, and obviously you'd have to get it through Parliament. You'd have to get enough support in the Commons and the Lords, etc. But you don't need to define it in a way that makes ER happen. You could just make ER happen. And as you say, we suspect that that may well be one of the recommendations in the report that comes out of this Select Committee inquiry. Partly because on one level, It's a relatively simple thing that Parliament could do to address some of the concerns. A lot of the other stuff that's been discussed in these oral hearings, if we're being honest, there's not a lot that Parliament can do. They are industry issues. They're contractual issues. Whereas just adding ER on streams on one level is a relatively simple solution. Except it isn't. I mean, it's a simple solution for Parliament. They could just rewrite copyright law, ER on streams. There you go, music industry. Figure it out. But actually, introducing ER on streams is not quite as simple as it has sometimes been portrayed in these oral hearings, which is not to say that that's a reason not to do it. But I do think if you apply ER on streams, aside from the various issues that have been raised by the record companies, and indeed the independents have raised a lot of concerns about this, as well as the majors. It's not just the majors who are generally against the idea of putting ER on streams. And there are various commercial arguments around why it shouldn't happen that the labels have been presenting. There's also this idea that sometimes ER is linked to blanket licensing or even statutory compulsory licensing, and nobody really wants to go down that route with streaming. But aside from the various issues that have been raised by the labels in the inquiry, there's also the fact that how do we introduce ER on streams? There's a lot of questions around that. You know, what does it mean? How would it work? What split will be allocated to ER? What happens once you go global? Are the collecting societies up to crunching all of the data? There's an awful lot of questions that would need to be answered if we were looking seriously into adding ER on streams. And most of those questions have not been discussed during this oral hearing because there wasn't any time, because everyone was obsessed about how we define a stream. So it will be interesting to see, once this inquiry reports, is ER on streams a recommendation? It could well be, but one would assume and one would hope that once that has happened, the various questions that we have been raising and some other people have raised in their submissions would then be addressed and considered and discussed. Because on one level, well, the line I've been using is that adding ER to streams would be a simple solution. It's just an incredibly complicated, simple solution. Which, in the context of music copyright, is a statement that makes sense.
Talking of how the money is divided up, the other big thing that came up again and again in the Select Committee inquiry was the idea of user-centric royalty payments. So paying out money based on what each individual user listens to, rather than seeing the platform as a whole and all listening on a platform as a whole.
Yeah, so plenty of support from particularly those people speaking for artists and songwriters, not only for ER applying to streams, but also the industry shifting over to user-centric. It was kind of interesting in terms of what the labels were saying, in that the majors, particularly in the written submissions that they made after their UK heads had actually answered questions in person, a lot of the majors were kind of saying, we see the benefits of user-centric, we're not completely opposed to it, although then sort of gave some reasons why it might not work or it wouldn't really help. Indie labels have also raised some concerns about user-centric, because actually, as well as skewing against the big pop superstars, it would potentially also skew against independent labels and independent artists as well, for various reasons. But lots of groups representing artists and songwriters and managers speaking in favour of a shift over to user-centric. This is an area where I do think some of the terminology that's used is a bit misleading, although it's not just MPs using this terminology, to be fair. Everybody is using it. Because one thing I've noticed is, we've actually got to a point now where people often refer to the current way that the money is divided up as being a pro rata system and then contrasting user-centric with it. But I mean, user-centric's a pro rata system. It's just, it's a pro rata system, as you say, where the money is split on a subscriber by subscriber basis rather than all the money and all the data from all the premium subscribers for Spotify in the UK, and then all the data and all the money from the free users in the UK and the premium users in Germany being pooled, and then the pro ratering happening on a sort of a product level, which is what is currently happening. So some slightly misleading language, I feel. But yeah, lots of support for user-centric coming out through the inquiry, and the labels kind of opposing it. The indies actually presented a really interesting and alternative approach, which they call the artist growth system for distributing royalties. Although I think that whereas the majors certainly Sony and Universal are sort of positioning themselves as being slightly agnostic towards user-centric. I suspect they would be dead against the proposal by the indies, because that would certainly skew against the biggest superstars. So some interesting arguments on all sides, but I suppose more interesting than any of that, more interesting than all of the support, chatter, criticism of user-centric within the context of the Select Committee inquiry, is the fact that in the middle of all of this, SoundCloud announced that it was doing user-centric.
Yes. Now that's, I mean, when SoundCloud says it's doing user-centric, it's different to Spotify suddenly announcing that it's doing user-centric, because SoundCloud obviously has various different business models for different users of its service. SoundCloud is not just a streaming service. And I mean, it's not even just one streaming service. And so it's only one part of its business that it's applying user-centric on, but it will be a kind of smaller scale way of testing whether or not user-centric would make a difference for some artists, or be bad, or just be the same. So it is interesting that SoundCloud has done this, even if not quite in the massive way that it may be suggested in its announcement.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, SoundCloud kind of stole Deezer's thunder on this, because user-centric, bigger debate at the moment than ever before, certainly here in the UK, but elsewhere as well, because of the Select Committee inquiry. Deezer have been pushing to do a pilot on user-centric for the whole of the recorded side in France, possibly Germany, for some time, yet to persuade all the labels to come on board for that. And then SoundCloud arrived with their big pilot. But yeah, I mean, as you say, I suppose it's important to clarify that because SoundCloud is different to Spotify, because it has all those different strands that you mentioned, and specifically user-centric is being applied to the independent creators. So those music makers who have a direct relationship with SoundCloud, they're part of the SoundCloud Premier scheme, or they use SoundCloud Repost, but there isn't a label or distributor between SoundCloud and the artist. And so basically every month, based on stats and consumption share, a portion of total money is allocated to the independent creators, and then a portion to the labels and distributors who provide content to SoundCloud, more like they do to Spotify, etc. And it is the money that goes to the independent creators which will then be shared out on the user-centric model rather than the service-centric model. But as you say, and I mean, Deezer reluctantly, I mean, you sort of felt that they were a little bit annoyed that SoundCloud had got there first, because of the unique way that SoundCloud is set up, and that SoundCloud can do it or a portion of their service rather than having to get everybody on board. But Deezer admitted that, yeah, I mean, it is a real world pilot that will be up and running from next month. And so it further tests the system. And for those people who support user-centric, I guess it's building more momentum around the methodology and the concept, which some people hope will persuade the entire record industry to embrace the Deezer-style pilot in France. And ultimately, in the Select Committee hearing, what the other streaming services, the Spotify's of this world, have been saying is, if the entire industry wants to go for a user-centric approach, there is some logistical stuff that would have to happen behind the scenes, but they are sort of agnostic on this point, is what Spotify's of this world have been saying. So the more pilots that are happening, the more momentum, maybe at some point in the future, everything would switch over to user-centric. So SoundCloud's announcement, very interesting and very interestingly timed.
So there's an awful lot that's been happening on the streaming side of the music industry in the last few months, but we should also mention the live side, because since we last recorded an episode of Setlist, Brexit proper has happened. The transition period ended, the UK severed all its ties with the European Union, and, big surprise, and it's amazing no one ever mentioned this at any point, it's not gone that well. And for the music industry, one of the things that's really not gone very well is that despite many, many promises by ministers, the final trade deal between the UK and the EU did not allow for the free movement of musicians around the European Union. Therefore, musicians from the UK will be left, once they're able to tour again, having to deal with EU countries on an individual basis. So some of those countries, it will be fine. They will allow UK artists to just go over, play a show, come back. Others, there will be a lot of red tape and cost in going there. And that therefore makes booking a tour around Europe, where previously you've just been able to go there and do your tour, come home, no issue, because of the EU principle of free movement, Now it's potentially going to be time-consuming to sort all that out and potentially costly, which for many artists, particularly smaller artists, will just mean they won't be able to tour Europe.
Yes, this all became clear right at the end of 2020 when the post-Brexit EU-UK trade deal was finally agreed and published with days to spare. And so on the 1st of January, it kicked in. Everyone in the music industry very quickly noticed that there were not EU-wide provisions to ensure that artists could tour and play across the European Union without having to sort out visas, travel permits, carnets for equipment, etc. It simply wasn't in there. We then ended up with several weeks where the UK said, oh, we tried to get it in there, but the EU said no. And then the EU said, no, we tried to get it in there. And the UK said no. And it turned out that both sides had proposals that would have helped musicians, but neither side liked the other side's proposals. And here we are nearly 3 months later. And if we're being honest, apart from a lot of discussion and a lot of debate, not a lot has moved forward. On one level, because the live industry is already in its COVID shutdown and the COVID lockdown is extending, and I mean, here in the UK, it's looking likely that maybe some socially distant shows will reappear in like May, and then maybe things will start to get back to normal over the summer, and then maybe international travel restrictions will start to lift later this year. I mean, that's kind of all best case scenario, but we're still very much within the COVID shutdown and all of the calamities around that. And on one level, the fact that all this Brexit shenanigans has come along at the same time as COVID is double the problem. Makes it all much worse because you've got a live industry that's already struggling. It's already on the edge. Although the flip side is because of COVID, nobody was touring anyway. I mean, in normal times, had the deal come out just before Christmas to kick in on the 1st of January, you would have had a lot of artists with tours already planned where everything would have been screwed up. So on one level, the fact nobody was touring meant that we had a little buffer where as soon as this problem was raised, different solutions could be considered, whether or not that is going back to the EU and trying to negotiate something, or whether it's doing standalone deals with every single country, or certainly those EU countries where a lot of British artists perform, and currently there are some tedious travel permits or carnet restrictions, which are going to be a problem. Getting those unilateral deals in place, putting a system in place to provide support to artists. Now, all of these things have been discussed. I mean, British ministers are in agreement that this is a big problem that needs to be solved. Lots of MPs in Parliament have been talking about this. All the things I just discussed and more are currently on the table. But actually, the one big thing that has happened this week, just gone, as this podcast goes out, is that the Musicians Union and the Incorporated Society of Musicians here in the UK put out a statement following the latest in a long number of debates in Parliament on this issue, basically saying there's a little list of things that have to happen to ensure that we can overcome these post-Brexit problems for musicians. We all now agree what those things are. The government is kind of saying it's going to do these things, but we don't sense that they're doing this super urgent. They seem to be saying, okay, we'll do a little bit of more investigation, a little bit more research before we start addressing these issues. And what MU and ISM are saying is, it's looking likely that people will start playing live again early summer. It could be that small-scale European tours are possible by the autumn, certainly by the start of next year. We need to get going with this stuff so that as soon as COVID restrictions are lifted, the barriers that could stop European tours are out of the way so that artists can get going as soon as possible to start making money from live shows across Europe. So yeah, it's sort of everyone in the music industry is seeing this as an absolute needs-to-be-solved-tomorrow problem. Whereas in government, although there is support and people agree things need to be done, those things don't seem to be happening at quite the speed the music industry would like.
So that's a quick roundup of some of the big music industry stories that have happened over the last 2 or 3 months, and I think are likely to rear their heads again on future editions of Setlist. So it's good to sort of get us all up to speed. But that's all we've got time for on this episode of Setlist.
Except,
oh,
not only has a lot been happening in the music business over the last few months, lots has been happening in the world of CMU that I've not had an opportunity to plug on the podcast.
I'm sure that's the thing people have missed the most.
So let me just get three very quick plugs in before we wrap up, because we do have to wrap up. So We've announced that The Great Escape is happening this year online only. Unfortunately, not able to go ahead with a full Great Escape in Brighton because of ongoing COVID restrictions. But the good news is there's going to be an online edition with both lots of great bands showcasing and the conference side, including the CMU Strands. So we're slowly announcing more details about the topics we're going to be covering and the speakers, etc. So go and check out The Great Escape website. You'll find the information on that. Get your tickets for the online edition. We're very excited about being able to do an online edition of The Great Escape this year. We've also launched a brand new series of white papers under the banner Building Trust with a content and platform security company Friend MTS. The first of those is a beginner's guide to the copyright safe harbor, which we've talked about a lot on Setlist. It's a very easy to follow introduction to the concept of the copyright safe harbor, the various controversies around it, and the reforms that are underway. And that's the first in a series of white papers which are going to be coming out in the coming months, all about the debates around platform responsibility and online harms. So go and check out the first of those. Talking of free guides, we are about to launch a beginner's guide to music copyright. CMU is working with the Intellectual Property Office in the UK on a brand new free guide called Music Copyright Explained. That will be available to download or access online later this month. We're also offering some free webinars and panel discussions around the launch of that. So if you go to musiccopyrightexplained.com, we'll put all the links to all of this in the podcast notes. Then you can find out more information about that. Find out how you'll be able to download the guide later this month and sign up for those free webinars providing some beginner's guide stuff to music copyright. I think that's probably enough plugging for now. I'll come back with another list of things to talk about next week.
Okay, well, that is now all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. We will put links to everything we've discussed here on this edition of the show in the show notes at setlistpodcast.com and also in the description that you've probably got up now in your podcast player of choice. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, review the podcast, email us with any questions or queries about anything at all, well, not anything at all, but you know, related to this at setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Morton, Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.